Hello and welcome to the Securities Compliance Podcast presented by the National Society of Compliance Professionals, where it is our mission to help you put compliance in context. I'm your host, Patrick Hayes, partner at the Calfee Law Firm. And on today's show, we will be serving up everything you need to know about Regulation SP and the upcoming compliance date for many firms. What are the new requirements? What are firms doing to prepare? And some best practices on implementation. To help guide us through the conversation, we are very pleased to welcome in Kristen Snyder and Charu Chandrasekhar from Debevoise Plimpton. In our headline section, we review the 2026 examination priorities from the SEC Division of Exams. And finally, we close up today with another installment of History Has Your Back, where we examine what a recent quote from an NBA superstar can teach us about conducting annual compliance reviews and the compliance profession. Moving into our headline section, in an annual report, the SEC Division of Exams recently identified priority areas for examination and highlighted key risks for investors and registrants in 2026. The division focused on the following priorities. For investment advisors, the division said it would continue to review their adherence to fiduciary duties with a focus on conflicts of interest, best execution, and recommendations involving complex products, including those made to older investors and retirement savers. The division also will assess the effectiveness of the advisor's compliance programs in areas such as marketing, valuation, and custody. And finally, it said it will also prioritize examinations of newly registered and other never-before-examined firms. For registered investment companies, the division said examinations will address fees and expenses, governance, and alignment between stated strategies and actual portfolio management and compliance with the amended names rule. For broker-dealers, the division said examinations will focus on compliance with regulation best interest, particularly recommendations on complex products, account types, and rollovers, as well as firms' conflict management practices. The division said further, it will also review compliance with financial responsibility rules, including net capital and customer protection requirements, alongside liquidity and credit risk management. Finally, additional reviews will also cover trading practices, best execution procedures, order routing disclosures, and regulation SHO compliance. For self-regulatory organizations, the division said it will continue to review governance, surveillance, and enforcement practices of national securities exchanges, as well as conducting risk-based oversight of FINRA and the MSRB. Finally, for clearing agencies, the division said examinations will focus on risk management frameworks, including liquidity, margin methodologies, model validation, and oversight of third-party service providers. In addition to those types of registrants, the division also said it will conduct examinations on other market participants, including municipal advisors, transfer agents, funding portals, and security-based swap dealers, with an emphasis on the following areas, including information security and operational resiliency. Here, the division said it will closely scrutinize registrants' cybersecurity practices, including data loss prevention, governance, access controls, vendor oversight, and incident response programs. The division said it will also evaluate compliance with the newly minted and now in effect Regulation SP and Regulation SID. Another area the SEC said it would focus on included emerging financial technologies. Here, the division said it will continue to assess firms' use of automated investment tools, AI, and trading algorithms, including whether disclosures about such technologies are fair and accurate, and whether their use leads to advice aligned with investors' profiles. The division said it will review controls over third-party AI systems, as well as firms' integration of regulatory technology. A couple other areas the SEC said it was looking at included anti-money laundering. Here, the division said it will examine whether firms have appropriately tailored the AML programs to business-specific risks, including independent testing, customer identification programs, and SAR filings, as well as evaluate compliance with U.S. Treasury sanctions. And finally, the last big area was under regulation systems compliance and integrity. Here, the division said it will review SCI entities to ensure they maintain systems designed for operational integrity and resiliency with a focus on incident response, cybersecurity defenses, and oversight of third-party vendors. And a special shout out to Kevin Harnish with Norton Rose and Fulbright and the U.S. Regulatory Intelligence blog for sharing their summary on the examination priorities. As we move into the interview session of today's show, we're going to be talking about a specific subject matter area that I imagine is very top of mind for many of our listeners in the compliance space these days, particularly if your firm happens to have over $1.5 billion in assets under management. But more specifically, we're going to be talking about Regulation SP and the recent amendments that were passed in 2024, and now with the first compliance date coming due here in the very near future. We're hoping today's show can help serve as a reminder for some of those firms that are going to have to come into compliance here in the very near future, and maybe a little bit of a roadmap for those firms that may be looking out ahead to their compliance date in June of 2026. As we start today's show, we bring back one Kristen Snyder, who we're very, very excited to have back on the podcast. Kristen did a fantastic job coming on before to talk about the PFAR rules way back when and what their impact was going to be on the industry. But she's here today to share her insights on Reg SP, and she brings with her a colleague, Charu Chandrasekhar, who's also here to dive deep into Regulation SP and give us some best practices about what they're seeing out there for firms that are approaching this area successfully, and some other key tips and tricks along the way. Before we get started, Kristen and Charu would love to hear a little bit about your respective practices over at Devovoice.
Thanks so much for having us, Patrick. It's really a delight to be here. As you noted, I had the pleasure of being on a prior podcast with you. I'm a partner in Devovoice and Plimpton's White Collar and Regulatory Defense Group, and I sit in our San Francisco office, and I work a lot with Charu, who will introduce herself in just a second. My prior background before coming to Devovoice was serving at the SEC for almost 20 years, and I was deputy director of the Division of Exams when I left, and that meant that we did a lot of initiatives in the cyberspace. So this is an area that I've been familiar with for a while, and now on this side of the table, have been counseling clients, particularly around the amendments to Reg SP as the due date comes up for compliance on December 3rd. And with that, I will pass the baton to Charu.
Great. Thank you so much, Patrick and Kristen. It's really great to be here. I'm Charu Chandrasekhar. I'm also a partner at Devovoice. I sit in New York, and I work in both the White Collar and Regulatory Defense Groups and our Data Strategy and Security Groups. Like Kristen, I was at the SEC in enforcement for 8 years, where I worked on a range of cybersecurity matters involving registrants. And now, like Kristen, on this side of the table, I work on SEC exams, enforcement, compliance, and the SEC cybersecurity space, and also have been working a lot with clients to get ready for the new SP amendments, which are coming live on December 3rd for big firms.
Yeah, no, thank you both. And very excited to have your depth and breadth of experience to bring to bear on today's show, and to share a lot of insights with our listeners. I think as we kick off the conversation today, I think it'd be really helpful if we could take a quick step back. And obviously, I am cautiously optimistic that most of our listeners at this point have probably are aware that these amendments are happening and have at least some baseline of Reg SP. Hopefully they're already complying with it because it's been in place for quite some time. But maybe Kristen, I could pick on you a little bit, if you wouldn't mind maybe sharing just a quick overview of some of the big highlights from some of the Reg SP amendments and what firms are being asked to do now that they weren't previously being asked to do.
Sure. I'm happy to cover those. So the amendments which went into effect in May of 2024. And then, as we've all noted, the compliance dates are coming up for large institutions on December 3rd, and then for smaller institutions later in the year or into 2026 in June. The amendments actually required and have brought to bear a number of significant changes. They, at a very high level, they now require, under the amended Reg SP, covered institutions, and the covered institutions are defined to include broker-dealers, registered investment companies, registered investment advisors, funding portals, and transfer agents must now adopt a formal incident response program and have written policies and procedures that are reasonably designed to detect and respond to and recover from any unauthorized access to or use of customer information. There's a notification requirement that now exists if sensitive customer information was or is or was reasonably likely to have been accessed or used without authorization. And I think the notification provisions are really what's significant for firms because that notification has to be made as soon as practicable, but no later than 30 days after the advisor becomes aware of a breach. And then there are some limited exceptions to that, which we can talk about, but that 30-day period is really something that firms are going to have to keep in mind. The definition of data covered have been broadened because the rule now covers not only customer information of the financial institution or the covered entity, but it also covers customer information that the advisor may have received from another financial institution. And that includes non-public personal information about customers, whether, again, it's collected by the advisor or by a financial institution with which the advisor or from which the advisor received the information. And then I think that a pain point, and I know Charu is going to talk about this as well, there are a lot of new obligations around service provider oversight. Covered institutions have to have procedures to oversee their third-party service providers that receive, maintain, or process customer information on the institution's behalf. And that, and I think the particular pain point is that there's now a requirement that the advisor have provisions or ensure that a service provider is able to notify the advisor promptly and typically within 72 hours of a breach that would affect customer data. And there are some nuances there. And then the amendments also require enhanced record keeping. So advisors are now required to maintain written documentation of policies and procedures, any breaches that have occurred, and any notifications or decisions not to notify customers when a situation arises. And then there also needs to be a record keeping around service provider oversight, and there are provisions that require secure disposal of customer information. So maybe I'll stop there because that was a big overview, and I know we're going to get into all of those topics in more detail.
No, it was a great overview. You covered a lot of ground, and I think did a really good job of summarizing what are a lot of those key points. And I know we're going to dig in on some of those items, but just when you kind of synthesize that and you think, okay, so we expanded the definition, formalized the policies that are needed, expanded the notification requirement significantly, and the third party oversight, right? Like you start adding these things on, you're like, wow, okay, so this actually is going to impact quite a number potentially of kind of the policies and procedures of the firm. And so I guess, you know, Charu, if I could flip over to you a little bit, you know, as firms are, you know, per Kristen's summary, there's a lot going on here. And obviously, I think some firms probably and some compliance officers and even legal practitioners in the space may find it hard because there's so much to chew on here. How do we get started? And so I guess what are some of the key considerations, you know, firms should be considering when deciding how they're going to go about trying to implement these new requirements of Reg SP into their policies and procedures?
Yep. So I would say first, firms really should size the risk and exposure under new Reg SP. I would say the first order of business is figuring out where do you have customer information that may come into the scope of the rule? Who are your impacted investors and where does that data reside? And that data mapping and data classification really is a threshold step to understanding your SP exposure. Just what information do I have and where does it sit? And then after that, you can start building out what is an incident response program? What are my policies and procedures? If I had a breach, what customer information would it impact? Where does that information live? And how would I get those notices out to customers? So really starting with first principles by understanding what the scope of the issue is will then allow the policies and procedures to flow after that point.
No, that makes complete sense. As you start to think about, and feel free for either of you to kind of think about which one of you would like to take this one, but do you think that firms are often going to, because after they've done some of that data mapping and you start to think about, okay, where are the areas where I have sensitive information that I know I need to protect? Do you see a lot of firms actually like dedicating a specific policy to Reg SP inside of their compliance manuals? Or are there other options where maybe instead of dedicating a specific policy to it, are they looking at, you know, maybe building in some of the relevant provisions into Reg SP into some of their existing policies and procedures?
Yeah, I would say we've seen it actually done in a combination in which you see a lot of compliance manuals have a section on privacy, on cybersecurity. There's usually a reference to Reg SP and its obligations, but then actually to implement the reg, the policies and procedures need to live in several different areas, like incident response, that's pure cybersecurity. And so you're likely going to have cybersecurity specific procedures in terms of just drafting the notice, getting it out to customers, making sure it's out the door within 30 days. And then also there's the whole vendor risk management piece, which is on a much shorter tail of 72 hours in which the vendors have to notify you. That usually lives within the vendor risk management program. So definitely we see the framework of the policy and the compliance manual typically, but then the SP obligations get operationalized through a whole suite of other policies and procedures.
I would agree. And I think it's one of those areas where it touches so many different parts of a firm. It's not just living within compliance. We're seeing a lot of cross coordination with the information security teams, you know, at larger firms. And so just making sure, it's not a one size fits all. I think there, to Charu's point, there are a number of different policies and procedures that might touch this area. And so we've tried to be, I think, as we're working with clients, relatively surgical because it is not a one size fits all. And so one set of policies, maybe it lives in one place at one firm, but it works better in a different place at another firm. And that's perfectly okay. I think it doesn't have to all be, you know, sort of in one spot. I think what is important is just making sure that you're going through the checklist of requirements under new SP and making sure that you do have everything covered, even if it's contained, you know, in different places.
Yeah, no, that's super helpful. And I'm glad to hear that firms can continue to kind of tailor even the implementation of Reg SP, just like they would have built their compliance manuals, right? Uniquely tailored to the firm's business and operations in kind of a very similar manner. How you incorporate Reg SP is probably going to be very indicative of how you've tailored the other parts of your compliance manual and the other stuff that you've built, right? So it's not, like you said, there's not necessarily a panacea or, you know, one size fits all. One area, though, that I think could be, I would love your additional thoughts on, and maybe we can dig in a little bit too, is in the area of record keeping. And I know, you know, there's a lot of parts in the amendments to Reg SP that talk about, you know, documentation around the supervision you're doing on service providers, documentation on some of your other, on some of the other requirements. So I'd be interested to get your thoughts kind of generally about some of those record keeping provisions and how you're seeing firms successfully implement those generally, and or how does disposal kind of impact some of the other policies and procedures there? Because I know, Kristen, you also mentioned in your summary some of the new requirements include kind of a disposal, you know, element to them. Maybe, yeah, Kristen, I'll pick on you. Or, you know, go ahead.
Yeah, no, I was going to say, Charu and I were talking about this a little bit earlier because some of the information that I think is meant to be safeguarded. So customer information that is covered by SP may not necessarily be a required record, you know, a book or record under the Advisors Act. And so you're correct that I think with disposal, you want to have secure methods in place. And many employee handbooks, you know, or the compliance manuals will have the record keeping provisions. Then we see some, you know, good hygiene around how records should be disposed of in the employee handbook. And sometimes it's connecting those two pieces, you know, in terms of getting the message out to employees. And we're seeing some enhancements even in employee handbooks or in the record keeping requirements too, just making references to things like shredding of documents or appropriate disposal methods for any kind of electronic media too. So I think that, you know, there's some overlap because if there's customer information that's maintained within a required record, obviously you're subject to the existing record keeping rules for investment advisors, so you would still comply with those. But in terms of disposal under SP, I think it's just being mindful after you do the data mapping exercise that Charu noted, knowing where your data is. If you no longer need certain pieces of sensitive information, then I think it's important to have those processes in place to have a deletion schedule so that you are able to be compliant and that you don't expose yourself to greater risk, you know, keep records longer than you need to that may subject you to breach notification if something were to happen at the firm.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. And I see in terms of record keeping, the biggest uplift here being the record keeping around incidents and responses to incidents, because firms have already had baseline SP policies and procedures. The new area now will be if you get an incident involving customer information, you have to document how you responded to it and whether customers were notified and to maintain those notifications as well. So I think that's an area to really be focused on.
Yeah, no, that's a great call out, Charu. And Kristen, back to your point, you know, I think I've seen a really big effort over the last couple of years, firms really taking more seriously kind of the data minimization efforts inside the firm to look, let's not necessarily just hang on to this information because we're used to doing it that way or just because it's there. It's like if there's a good effort, especially when it contains, you know, sensitive materials that ultimately could get exposed through some kind of unauthorized party, it's like what a great way to help reduce the firm's risk in a lot of areas as with regard to having a really good disposal policy in place and getting rid of those records when you no longer need them. One of the other key areas that I know we're going to need to have really good record keeping is in regard to vendor risk management and vendor supervision. So that's obviously kind of a now completely folded into the requirements of Reg SP, where I think, look, if you could even fall back on the Advisors Act fiduciary duty and kind of other stuff previously to say, hey, look, if you're hiring vendors to do something involved in your advisory services that you're delivering to clients, best practices is that let's do some good due diligence on those folks and kind of, you know, kick the tires to make sure that that's going to be in the best interest of your clients. But now with Reg SP, some of the supervision that we do, some of that is going to be built into the rule itself. So maybe I picked on Kristen last time. So Charu, I'll go back to you first this time. How can firms start to properly establish good vendor risk management kind of in wake of the new requirements?
Yep. So this area of vendor risk management is one that survived the SEC's prior attempts to exercise broad authority over vendor risk management through the now failed outsourcing rule proposal, but this lives on through SP. So I would say the baseline is obviously asset managers have sometimes dozens and dozens of vendors that are handling customer information, handling PII. And so again, it goes to first principles, just trying to get your arms around who are your vendors and what customer information do they hold, and exercising some basic hygiene in terms of understanding what their safeguards are, what their policies and procedures are, e.g., like what encryption do they have, for instance, what procedures do they have against unauthorized transfers of information? And so just diligencing the vendors already, if that's not been done, just on cybersecurity hygiene and specifically safeguarding this very sensitive zone of information that's in focus for the SEC. And then, of course, now there is this kind of situation where the SEC wants to have it both ways. Obviously, it can't regulate vendors themselves, but they're trying to regulate vendors through us as advisors. And going to the vendors and saying, look, the SEC wants you to tell me within 72 hours if you have a breach. You can try to achieve that via contract, but that can be challenging to do, just to renegotiate a contract and to get that provision in place. You can try to reach out to vendors with letters of expectation saying, look, the SEC has put this onus on me, so therefore I'm putting it on you to let me know within 72 hours if you have a breach involving my customer data. But taking all of these steps from hygiene to working with them on the 72-hour notice requirement, I think it really goes back to just surveying your landscape of vendors, knowing who has what where, and just making sure you're uplifting that whole program in compliance with what SEC Reg SP requires by the SEC.
And this is a tough spot. And that's, I think, where we've seen much of the consternation, because it is tough, as Charu noted. You know, you can't necessarily control what the vendor is going to do. And I think many vendors, especially smaller vendors where you might have a bit more leverage, it's maybe easier to negotiate these provisions. But for really large vendors that maybe cover not just the asset management industry, but, you know, very broad swaths of companies, you know, the marketplace just more generally, it's just tough to get those sorts of confirmations. And so I think sometimes the letters of expectation that Charu referenced may be your best bet, just to at least demonstrate to the regulators that you've taken the steps steps that you can reasonably take, and you can't force the vendors to, you know, maybe come into or help you come into compliance. But I think showing those whatever steps that you can, that you have made an effort, will go a long way if you're examined.
You both are speaking directly to my heart right now. Honestly, I feel like over the last 4 to 5 months, this thing, more than any other thing, has not only been one of the areas where lots of firms are spending a lot of resources, right? Because as you know, Charu, you noted, firms can have a lot of service provider relationships that you work with, right? And as those continue to climb, and then it was going back to identify, okay, well, like you said even earlier on our show, okay, what types of information do those service providers have? Is it the kind of information that's subject to Reg SB? Okay, let's go look at our contract, right? And let's go see what the provisions say right now around breach notification. Okay, well, let's say as soon as practicable. What does that mean? Let's figure out. And so you start digging in there. But I guess, you know, one of the things, and you talked about it a moment ago, but I think it would be really, I would love to hear your thoughts on maybe are there any other things that a firm could look to do, right? If it's done everything it can, right? It's done the right data mapping. It's identified the vendors. It's looked at the agreements. They reached out to vendors to confirm that they would meet the 72-hour requirement. Some said they would. For others, they sent a letter of expectation and feel pretty good that they're going to meet that. And then let's say they get pushback, right, from a couple vendors that, again, there are some behemoths out there that have a little bit more punching power than others. When they say they won't, or at least they don't confirm that they will do that. And so you've got that good faith effort on your side. Is there anything else that you could be doing internally to help kind of set yourself up for success potentially, right? If an examination comes or something else comes that can help continue to justify why you as a firm continue to work with that vendor. And maybe I think I picked on Charu last, so now maybe Kristen, I'll pick on you.
It's a great question, and it's a tough question. And I think where the exam staff or a regulator could press on the firm is if it's a vendor that maybe is not critical to the firm and there are other alternatives out there that the firm could work with. If they can't get any kind of comfort, you know, maybe that vendor. And I think that's these situations are going to be few and far between, because I think most firms have vendor due diligence processes in place already. And so you're doing a lot of that upfront checking to make sure that you feel confident, especially for vendors who are going to have access to some of your confidential information. But I think for a larger vendor that maybe there aren't a lot of options in the marketplace and you otherwise have a fair amount of confidence, you know, thinking of cloud storage providers or email platform providers, where it's very difficult to make a switch and it can be very costly, and the cost benefit really weighs in favor of keeping that vendor relationship, or maybe they're the only game in town. I think just documenting the efforts and the steps that the firm took to try to ensure that vendor would be in compliance with the new requirements is, you know, would be a good set of information to be able to pull out, you know, if an examiner came in and asked why, you know, for instance, a 72-hour notification provision wasn't baked into your agreement with that particular vendor. And I think the letters of expectation that Charu referenced, you know, we're generally sending them out, or those are being sent out under negative consent. I think what you are flagging though, Patrick, is where you actually maybe engage with the vendor and they say, well, we just can't comply with that requirement. Mm-hmm. We've seen some modified language be put into place too, that maybe doesn't exactly track the rule, but it gets to a place that is almost there, and it gets to a place where the vendor might be comfortable signing up to something. So that's another approach. And ultimately just, you know, documenting the efforts that you took to try to get the vendor, you know, kind of all the way there in the language.
Yeah. No, thank you. Charu, did you have anything to add to that, or would you agree with what Kristen said?
Yeah, agree with all that Kristen said, documenting your steps to get the vendor in compliance, but also documenting why you believe the vendor, if it's one of these behemoths, is relatively low risk, and why the switching costs would be really high, and why keeping the vendor is actually consistent with your fiduciary obligations.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, I think that's really a sharp take on that. And you know, one other thing that we also found a little bit is, sometimes too, if you get a little bit of initial pushback from the vendor, another tactic that has worked is having a little bit of follow-up to, I don't think educate is the right word, but that's kind of what I mean. Because in a couple cases, when we had follow-up with the vendor, we were like, hey, look, we understand, At 72 hours after an incident has occurred, we're not asking you to tell us what all of what has been breached by that point, or having identified the source of the breach by that point. We understand you're still going through kind of full forensics and testing and other stuff to identify that. And we don't, we're not asking you for that. All we're asking is just for a heads up that something has happened, right? Because then that puts us in the best position possible to meet our requirements under Reg SP, and then ultimately 3 or 4 weeks down the line, we can have a little bit more follow-up so that then we can meet our other notification requirement out to our customers because of their data being the actual content that was, you know, actually accessed. So that's also been helpful, is having a little bit more contextual conversations with the service providers to say, hey, look, we're not asking for the full forensics report within 72 hours. We're just asking for a heads up that something has happened.
Yep, totally agree.
Okay, so diving into, now that we've covered a lot of the policies and procedures part and maybe some of the vendor due diligence part, I think it would also be really, really helpful. Would love to pick both of your brains on, we're going to move into the hypothetical stage here, where if you were starting a firm from scratch, what are some of the best practices that firms should consider when they're developing, right, their kind of broader information security and governance and cybersecurity frameworks inside those firms, right? So we get the benefit now. We are at, you know, a standing start. What would be some kind of best practices that you would say would be good for firms to build in?
I think I would take a 10,000 foot view and not only consider Reg SP, but there are so many different cyber patchwork, framework, notification requirements, privacy considerations. And so just having a good sense, and I think that's what's been beneficial, honestly, through this process as we've helped firms, you know, do an uplift to get ready for SP, is that a lot of, you know, firms have really taken into consideration, I think, in crafting their policies and procedures. And I think if you were starting from scratch, just knowing all of the obligations that you're subject to. So it could be state law, privacy and breach notification requirements. If you have business that takes place abroad and you've got touch points and their privacy regulations like GDPR that are abroad. And so I think just being mindful of all of that and crafting your policies in a way that's flexible enough. And that's what we've seen, you know, with a number of the policies that we've worked with. And that's why it's been easier to be surgical. They're crafted in a way that might maybe required some minor tweaking for Reg SP, but they were also broad enough to cover all of those different obligations and requirements. So I think, you know, again, maybe starting out 10,000 feet and just understanding what are you subject to, and then mapping from there, and then having those policies and procedures put together in a way that you can operationalize, because as we've all seen, like, you could have the most beautiful compliance procedures, you could have great incident response. If it's not implementable at your firm, it's not going to be helpful. And that's precisely what the exam staff looks at when they come in, is they want to understand, okay, well, here's your policy, here's your procedure, show me how you actually implemented all of that. And so I think, you know, just again, making sure that you've got your policies sort of right sized, and that's just at a very high level. And then I think just understanding who is going to own each of those policies and procedures. So having a map, you know, if you're mapping out what you're subject to, and you've got the requirements, you know, for Reg SP in front of you and other cyber policies and procedures just to keep your system safe, who owns those? And if there's a problem, you know, I think doing tabletop exercises just to test all of that is really important. And I'll stop talking there because I know Charu will have other great insights.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I think if I had to design my dream registered investment advisor from a cybersecurity standpoint, I would want to make sure, obviously, in addition to a compliance manual that talked about SP, would want to make sure there was a written information security policy in place, a WISP, that just has the framework for the firm's approach to cybersecurity. And then obviously a very practical, specific, hands-on incident response program or policy with, as Kristen said, just really nuts and bolts on how would you deal with an incident? Who would pick up the phone and call whom? When do you send out notices to customers under the patchwork of regulations? And a policy that you can also actually test by doing tabletop exercises, by putting people through mock simulations of incidents, I think is really the best way to ensure that your policies and procedures actually work on the ground if you have an incident like this that comes in the door that impacts customer information.
Yeah.
I'm also going to plug, oh, sorry, Patrick. No, go ahead.
No. Please go.
Yeah, I was going to plug, because Charu just gave a training on this, but I was going to plug Regulation SID also, because it sometimes gets forgotten about, I think, or that's what we've seen at times, either on exams or when we're doing some of these reviews. It's been in place for a long time, and it does have, you know, a requirement that it needs to be periodically reviewed and refreshed to determine if firms have covered accounts and if either any new risks that should be included in the Reg SID policy. And in some places we've seen it's more of a set it and forget it. And so I think as you're looking at your SP obligations or building out your cyber program, don't forget about Reg SID. And, you know, I think sometimes with SID, just like other cyber policies, it's super beneficial, especially if you're in a larger organization, to make sure that you're connecting in with the AML team and the fraud team, because different people are seeing different risks or issues. And I think having a way to consolidate that information. So if I was building like the perfect governance structure, having a committee that would pull from, you know, different groups within a firm, and in a smaller firm, you have the benefit of maybe some of those folks are doing the same jobs, and so you're seeing everything and able to adjust your policies accordingly. But in a larger org, I think it's really helpful to have your IT group, you know, somebody from information security connected in with compliance. And then, you know, if there's a fraud prevention group that's separate from that, you know, making sure that they're an AML, that they're all connected together.
Absolutely wonderful advice from both of you there. And Kristen, to build on one of the items that you mentioned there, I mean, we see it certainly, you know, plenty with some of the other registrants that we work with, where whether they're large or small, having those, you just mentioned a lot of the relevant functional kind of areas inside the firm, having those people talk to each other, right? And making sure that, and a lot of times that's through like a compliance committee, or maybe it's a cybersecurity committee in some instances, but where you are able to connect, right, the people that are going to be on kind of the information security, IT, cybersecurity side, and then those persons that are in compliance or in operations or in some of those other key functional areas. It's just so critically important that those folks are kind of interfacing with each other, having a dialogue with regard to what some of these requirements are, and making sure, you're going back to one of the things that Charu said, that you say what you do and do what you say, right? Again, like you can have the best policies and procedures in the world. They can, you know, be absolutely pristine in how they are presented, but if you're not able to execute on them, they're not going to do you any good when it comes to an examination, right? And you need to make sure that if you say you're going to do it, that you're actually able to back that up, and that the firm is actually doing that. And that's actually probably a good segue, because I know one of the things, another question we've been getting recently from some other folks that are certainly in the group of registrants that have to come into compliance with Reg SP here in the next few weeks, is what should they be expecting from an exam staff, right, that's coming out of a shutdown right now? And, you know, we're a couple weeks out. You can see, you know, at least with, you know, kind of more anecdotal than anything else, but some of the exams that we've been working on have kind of kicked back up again, and there's other stuff that's certainly happening in the space. So we see some of that activity, you know, starting to resurface. But as two former alums of the staff, I would love to get both of your thoughts on what we could potentially expect from the exam staff kind of coming out of the shutdown. And maybe Charu, I'll start with you.
Sure. Yep. So it's a really timely question, Patrick, because as we all know, the SEC just put out its exam priorities. Not surprisingly, Reg SP and SID too, but especially Reg SP made the list. And so I think what we can expect to see based on what the staff has signaled is we will see exams focusing on baseline compliance with the new amendments to SP. Is there now an incident response program in place above and beyond what the baseline for SP already was? Does that program reasonably have structures in place to identify cybersecurity incidents, that is to detect them and then to respond to them? And then, of course, do they have mechanisms actually to get those notices out to customers within that 30-day time window? And again, that's underscores the need for knowing who your customers are and where they are. And so just testing the basic nuts and bolts compliance of adherence to the new amendments, I would say. So I don't know that we're going to get to advanced topics and SP compliance. I know there are a lot of edge cases that can come up with, well, are these really my customers if I'm a private fund advisor, or if I'm operating through a series of different vehicles, ultimately, do I have exposure to the data? I don't think we're going to get into any of those really complicated edge cases with SP, but I think at this first round, the staff will want to see just good hygiene, good compliance with the new requirements.
That's great. Yeah. Kristen, do you have anything to add to that?
Yeah, no, I agree with everything that Charu said. And usually when we see a new rule roll out like this or amendments to the rule, then there is this information gathering period where I think the staff will do an initiative and they'll try to ensure that firms are actually adopting, you know, amended policies and procedures in response to the rule. And then we generally see some information report outs. Maybe it'll be through a risk alert or other guidance. And then to Charu's point, I think as the staff gets more sophisticated and as they have put out more guidance and they have greater expectations that firms have had more time to comply and have seen this additional guidance, then I think we'll start to see elevated requirements from the staff. And that's the way, you know, if you look at other rules like regulation best interest, you know, mm-hmm. we kind of saw that progression. We saw that with the marketing rule. And so I think we can expect to see that sort of same playbook with Reg SP.
Yeah. No, that's great. And that's super helpful. Again, I think, you know, this was the longest, you know, shutdown in history. And so I know firms have a lot of questions about kind of what to expect. And so I think it's helpful to give them some additional context there. As we close up the conversation on Reg SP, I guess maybe I'll throw one more question to you, which is, other than any of the items that we've kind of covered on today's show, you know, is there anything else specifically tied to the rule or the new requirements that either we haven't discussed or maybe that we did discuss, but you would just want to call out again for firms to kind of really pay attention to, or some other kind of maybe lessons learned as you've been working with other registrants? Maybe it's, you know, something successful that they've done as they've approached trying to meet the requirements underneath the new rule.
I guess one thing that comes to mind, and we've done a lot of thinking and speaking on this topic, is just, and Charu alluded to it, I think, in the last part of the conversation, I think this has been a bit more of a challenge for private fund advisors, just because it does require, you know, a mental exercise to figure out, well, who are my customers, who are the customers of other financial institutions in the information that I might have in my files, you know, related to those customers. There was, the SEC actually put on, and I'm sure folks may have seen it, a webinar for large advisors that were subject to the compliance date on December 3rd. And there was a question that came up around private fund advisors, and the staff just really repeated the language from the adopting release. You know, when the question asked, I think, was along the lines of, how does this apply to private funds? And the staff answered by saying, well, it's not only your customer information, but it's the customer information that's provided to you by other financial institutions. And I think the implication there was that maybe a private fund is akin to another financial institution. And if you have natural person LPs in that private fund, and you have that information in your files, you know, that is customer information of another financial institution. So I think that's, there have been some interpretive questions that will maybe get sorted out, you know, around private fund or the information that's retained by private funds. But in terms of best practices, I think really, again, there's no one size fits all if you haven't started preparing. And I'm assuming that most folks on this, you know, who are going to be listening have, but if you haven't, I think the time is now. And and it's not as, and I will say, maybe one surprising point, I think some of the work that's to come, you know, the notification requirements and other things are going to, you know, there are certainly significant new responsibilities. And so I don't want to downplay that. But maybe to give some hope to folks, if you haven't started, is that you can be somewhat surgical, I think, with the policies and procedures you already have. So if you haven't started, get started now.
Yeah. Fingers crossed they've gotten started. But yeah. If you haven't, the time is now.
Yeah.
Charu, was there anything else you wanted to add?
Yeah, I would say, I guess one topic that's top of mind for me really is just how quickly fraud has been emerging. And so this is relevant both to SP and to SID. Is with AI, we just see very quickly evolving fraud tactics in the cybersecurity space. So I would say that's to Kristen's point, it's why it's good to have connectivity with AML and fraud more generally to understand the types of threats customers are seeing and how threats are evolving, just to be able to build good defenses and to be proactive about fraud prevention.
Really great advice from, you know, both of you. And I really, really appreciate you sharing that. And I really appreciate you coming on the show today to share your fantastic insights on Reg SP. We have a saying around these parts, though, that no good deed goes unpunished. And I know I said that the last one was going to be the last question, but I did have one more. And for those listening here at home, Kristen and Charu have been so generous. They're actually recording this podcast on the eve of the Thanksgiving holiday. So I thought maybe a fun final question for you both would be, what is the thing you are most looking forward to eating tomorrow on the Thanksgiving holiday?
Well, I know what I'm most looking forward to eating, which is multiple slices of pie across different flavors. As Kristen knows, I sent my husband to go pick up the pies a couple of hours.
Love
so
that.
I was manning that situation while on a different call with Kristen, but the pies have now made it home safely. So I'm really looking forward to eating about three or four slices tomorrow.
Are we talking like pumpkin, pecan, all the pies?
Okay. Yes, we have one blueberry crumble. We have an apple. We have a pumpkin. So.
I love all of it. That's awesome. What about you, Kristen?
I wish I lived around the corner. That sounds amazing. Yeah. My daughter is making for the first time. So we have all of the, you know, all the fun staples, and now the kids are getting involved in the cooking. And so my daughter is making, and I'll keep you posted, but it's French onion soup, mac and cheese. Don't know. I mean, it sounds very interesting. So I'm interested to try that more than anything else.
I'm interested to follow up on how it goes. That sounds incredible. Yeah. I mean, I like both of those things independently. So, you know, this is great. That sounds fantastic. Well, for me, I guess it's definitely, I mean, Thanksgiving is such a great holiday. You know, it doesn't have the pressure that some of the other holidays have. You're just going to get together with friends and family, and it's all about the carbs. Right. So, but for me, there's stuff, but for me, it's mom's mashed potatoes. I got to go. Mom's mashed potatoes is what I'm looking forward to the most. Cause I don't typically have mashed potatoes. It's just like, take some time to make and, you know, everything. So I'm looking forward to carbo loading tomorrow, at the Thanksgiving feast. So, well, again, thank you both so much for coming on the show today. Really, it was an absolute delight. And thank you again for sharing your fantastic insights on Regulation SP. And looking forward to having you both back on the podcast here at some point down the road. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Have a great Thanksgiving.
The final part of today's show features another segment of History Has Your Back. As a quick reminder for some of our new listeners, this segment represents the part of the podcast where we go back in time to help us better understand the present, help define where we're headed in the future, and demonstrate how the lessons of the past can be applied to our compliance programs today. In today's History Has Your Back, we're looking at some recent history with NBA star Giannis Antetokounmpo. In 2023, after his team, the Milwaukee Bucks, were eliminated from the postseason, Giannis was asked a very direct question. Do you view this season as a failure? And his answer was enlightening. He said, quote, "Do you get a promotion every year on your job? No, right? So every year you work is a failure. Yes or no? No. Every year you work towards something, towards a goal, which is to get a promotion, to be able to take care of your family, to be able to provide a house for them, or take care of your parents. You work towards a goal. It's not a failure. It's steps to success. There are always steps to it. Michael Jordan played 15 years. Won 6 championships. The other 9 years were a failure? That's what you're telling me? It's a wrong question. There's no failure in sports. There's good days, bad days. Some days you're able to be successful. Some days you're not. Some days it's your turn. Some days it's not your turn. And that's what sports is about. You don't always win. Sometimes other people win. And this year, somebody else is going to win. Simple as that. We're going to come back next year, try to be better, build better habits, try to play better. End quote. As the end of the year approaches, and as many compliance officers and CCOs start looking towards completion of their annual compliance reviews and risk assessments, it's easy to fall into the trap of viewing all of the errors and omissions and instances where the firm might have colored outside the lines or come up short in certain areas as failures. I think a key takeaway from Yannis's quote is that we in compliance must remember that this is supposed to be a process. Every year is not going to be perfection. We need to be comfortable with that. And like Yannis says, come back next year, try to be better, and build better habits. Much like athletes do, we need to look at the game film, watch the tape, and get the annual review done. But the motto of this show has always been, make it better than the way we found it. And the annual review is the perfect opportunity for compliance officers to demonstrate the enhancements the firm has made to the program over the last year and the positive direction it's headed, even if it didn't quite attain perfection. And that will do it for today's show. I'd like to thank our sponsors, CALFI and the National Society of Compliance Professionals, and extend a big thank you to our guests, Kristen Snyder and Charu Chandrasekhar, for coming on the show today and sharing their fantastic insights on Reg SP and what firms can do now to make sure they're ready for the upcoming new requirements. Please join us again next time on the Securities Compliance Podcast, where we help you put compliance in context. Please check us out on LinkedIn. You can search for Compliance in Context Podcast or on X using the handle @CompliancePod. You can like us and subscribe to us on Apple Podcasts or wherever you find your favorite podcasts, or go to ComplianceInContextPodcast.com to listen and learn more.